It's a great pleasure to be here and a great pleasure to have the opportunity to tell you a little bit about the excitement of the science in modern genetics. Some hint, I hope, of the mathematical and statistical challenges in the area, and there are many of them, and to try and convey a sense of the way in which those developments in genetics and genomics, as we would say, will impact on human health and healthcare in the coming years and probably decades. Before I do that, I want to give you a piece of practical advice directed particularly at those of you who aren't yet already professional mathematicians or statisticians. We all have a bit of a challenge in the social situation where someone comes up to you and says, "What do you do?" It's hard, it's always hard to encapsulate that. If you're a mathematician or a statistician, it's never easy. And it's a kind of challenge I've never managed to meet. Lots of reasons for that. Statistics isn't such an exciting profession from the outside. Those of us on the inside might think differently. Doesn't have great street credibility. There are a number of aphorisms about statisticians and statistics which I like. One of them is that statisticians are people who like working with numbers, but don't have the personality skills to become accountants. And another one of the self-deprecating lines we have in our profession is the rhetorical question, how do you tell the extroverted statistician from the introverted one? To which the answer is that the extroverted statistician looks at the other person's shoes. As I said, I've never been very good in that social situation of kind of succinctly explaining what we do. You should try it one day, even afterwards. Someone comes up to you and says, "Well, what do you do?" Try saying, "I'm a statistician." Here's what will happen. There'll be a kind of glazing over of the other person's eyes, and then you've got a vague sense of cogs whirring as they try and work out how to get out of this. And if they're quick thinking, they'll look over your shoulder and say, "Oh my gosh, there's Felicity. I've been meaning to catch up with her for ages. Will you excuse me?" And if they're not so quick thinking, they'll take a little while, and then they'll mumble something about needing another drink and off they'll go. So it's a good way to get rid of people if you don't want to talk to them. I've never done it very well. Many years ago now, my then girlfriend did a much better job than I've been able to do. At the time, I was working in America, she was working for the BBC in the UK, and I was coming to visit. It was early in our relationship, so she'd actually paid attention when I talked about the work I was then doing, which, as David explained, was about trying to model the way in which populations evolve through time and the way in which their genetic composition changed with time. So when I was coming to visit, and one of Sarah's colleagues said to her, "Oh, what does your boyfriend do?" She thought for a while and said, "He models things." Well, you can imagine she got rather interested at this point, and so the woman said to her, "What does he model?" And Sarah paused a bit more and said, "Genes." "He models genes." Needless to say, she was very disappointed when she finally met me. So what I want to try and do, as I said, is to give you a sense of the changes in genetics over about the last 20 or so years and the stage we've got to and where the science is going. So I'll start by explaining, and I'm sure many of you will be aware, that as far as genetics and human diseases go, there's a spectrum. At one end of that spectrum are diseases where genetics is all the story. Those diseases are thankfully rare, they're usually serious, and they have the property that if you inherit in some cases one, and in some cases two, changed or mutated copies of the gene in question, you get sick, usually very sick. So examples you probably have heard of are cystic fibrosis and Huntington's disease. There are many, many more. And while they're individually rare, it's suggested that there are perhaps 1% of children born each year who will be affected at some stage in their life, often early in their life, but at some stage in their life, by genetic disorders. For many of these disorders, they're called Mendelian because they follow simple rules of inheritance, the rules that Mendel discovered many years ago in studying peas. They're called Mendelian. For many of them, the genes involved and the genes where the changes underlie the condition have been identified. And in fact, over the last few years, with changes in our ability to measure DNA, there's actually been a resurgence and a lot more discovery for these rare but serious Mendelian conditions going on over the last couple of years and still ongoing. And I'll actually talk about one of them a little later in the talk. So one of the most common examples, at least in Caucasian populations, is a very serious condition called cystic fibrosis. It affects one in about 2,500 people. The identification of the gene involved was one of the big early successes. It's in some sense the start of what we come to think of as the modern age in human genetics. That happened through a number of groups in 1989. There's been a huge amount of success since then. So I'll go on to explain And again, as many of you will know, that our genetic information is encoded in DNA, which we can think of as an instruction manual. It's a very sobering thought that the most common reason for getting cystic fibrosis is a change that involves taking out just three letters, three out of the 3 billion letters in our DNA. Those are missing in some people. In fact, that's not so uncommon. About 1 in 25 people carries that change. And if you happen to inherit that change from your mother and also from your father, then you suffer from the condition. The identification of the gene hasn't yet led to a kind of magic pill that can cure it or to therapies that can cure it. Although very recently, the first drug therapy directed at one particular change, actually not this common one, but one other change in the gene was announced and trialed and turns out to be very successful. So that, to give you a sense of the timescale, and it's not unrealistic, that's more than 20 years since the discovery of the gene, but it's starting to bear fruit. The discovery of the gene has been helpful in other ways, not least in enabling us to diagnose kids suffering from this at a very early stage and to direct the treatments that we do have and therapies at them. In the 1960s, someone born with cystic fibrosis had a median life expectancy of about 10 years, and that's now about 40. And part of that's through knowing the gene. We hope in time we'll actually be able to develop therapies, and as I said, the first of those has just been published, that use the information from genetics to cure or substantially improve the condition for people. I guess the next big breakthroughs, and some of the most important breakthroughs, occurred in the mid-1990s with the discovery of two genes involved in familial forms of breast cancer. As you'll see a little bit later in the talk, most genes have very unmemorable names or acronyms. These genes are called BRCA1, BR for breast and CA for cancer, 1 and 2. And individuals, to give you a sense, individuals who carry a mutation, a particular kind of mutation in BRCA1, have a greatly elevated risk of breast cancer, about 80%, so for an average woman that risk is more like 10%, and a substantially increased risk of ovarian cancer. It is the case with those genes, but only very recently, that we've been able to take advantage of the genetics to think about developing therapies. But irrespective of that, identification of the gene has been important for women in families that carry breast cancer much more than you'd expect. Those women now have the option of deciding whether to be tested for a mutation in BRCA1 or 2 or not. If they choose to be tested, there's a 50-50 chance that they won't carry the mutation. So obviously, that's hugely valuable information and a great relief for the women involved. If they choose to be tested and carry the mutation, then there are tough decisions, but there are various things that can be done, surgically and otherwise, to substantially reduce their disease risk. So it's made a big difference to patients potentially at high risk. The next major advance in this kind of potted history that I'm talking and walking you through in genetics was the success of the Human Genome Project. Now, what do we mean by a genome? The genome is a collection of the entirety of the DNA that an organism carries. In humans, our DNA is made up of about 3 billion letters. You can think of them as letters in the DNA code. And in humans, it happens to be organized into 23 pairs of chromosomes. Kind of tempting to think that we're amongst the more sophisticated creatures that pot around the planet, and hence that we need a lot of DNA to encapsulate that sophistication. That's roughly true, but it's a sobering thought that salamanders, little lizards, have about 10 times as much DNA as we do. The Human Genome Project read one copy of our DNA. The early version was reported in 2001, the complete version in about 2003, to a great deal of fanfare. So Nature is one of the major science magazines. It was very excited about it, so was Science. And in fact, there was a press conference jointly between Professor Clinton and Tony Blair to announce what they saw as this great advance. Not unnaturally, 10 years on, so a year or two ago, there was a lot of kind of retrospective and forward-looking speculation about whether the Human Genome Project had delivered and whether we'd gained as much as we might have expected and where the world would be going. I think actually the Human Genome Project and the Human Genome Sequence has been hugely important, in a sense for indirect reasons rather more than direct reasons. We learnt some important biology from knowing the genome sequence, but I think the best way to think about it is that the genome sequence is like a map. Our genomes are huge, vast and largely unexplored territories. Having the sequence enables us, in a sense, to put coordinates down. We know where we are and where this bit of information in our DNA is in relation to others. Trying to do human genetics before, it's hard to imagine actually for many of us relatively new to the field, trying to do human genetics before the human genome sequence was like trying to be an explorer of some of the more interesting and exotic parts of the Earth in the days when either there were no maps or there weren't very good maps. And it's that ability to know where things are in the genome that's had a huge follow-on consequence, some of which I'll talk about in this lecture. So you can think of the Human Genome Project and the Human Genome Sequence as encapsulating the stuff in our DNA which makes us human, the stuff that we have in common. And if you compare the DNA sequences between two individuals, or more precisely, between one copy of a human chromosome and another copy of a human chromosome, those sequences are almost identical. They agree at about 999 places out of 1,000. So they're almost identical, but one difference in 1,000 amongst 3 billion bits of information or piece of information in our DNA is still a lot of differences. And a lot of the focus in research in general, and my own work and the things I want to talk about, has been to do with understanding the consequences of those differences for medically relevant traits. So how do particular differences in DNA change someone's susceptibility to this disease or that disease, for other human traits like height and weight and so on, and other aspects of human conditions. Again, it's kind of encouraging that most of our DNA is the same across two individuals. I said that if you compared your DNA, DNA from one of your chromosomes with the DNA from another one, say the person sitting next to you, they differ at only about one place in 1,000. If, with all due respect to them, you just pretended that the person sitting next to you were in fact a chimpanzee for a little while and compared your DNA with a chimpanzee's DNA, then they'd agree at 99 places out of 100. So although we're species that are separated by about 5 million years in evolution, our DNA is still remarkably similar. I talked at the beginning of the talk about diseases which were rare and where genetics was all of the story. Actually, much of the current research focus is on common human disease, diseases like heart disease and diabetes and arthritis, many of the cancers, and mental health disorders. We know for all of those that genetics is a part of the story. Some of the explanation for the way in which people's susceptibility to disease differs amongst individuals is due to their DNA. We also know that genetics is only part of the story, that some of those differences are due to external factors, what we would think of as the environment, things like diet and lifestyle and so on. It's, if you like, nature on the one hand, our DNA, and nurture the environment. And until recently, although there's been a huge amount of research effort to try and understand how genetic differences are related to differences in susceptibility to disease, until fairly recently, there hadn't been much progress. Quite a lot of false dawns, but not much progress. And then that picture changed. So I'm going to show you a series of cartoons like this. How should you think about this? Each one of these kind of stripy vertical things represents one of the human chromosomes. We've got 23 pairs of chromosomes. The biggest one is called chromosome 1, chromosome 2, and so on. So what I'm illustrating, what does this little lollipop mean, if you can see it? That's marking a particular place on human chromosome 1, where in 2005 we learned that changes in DNA sequence in that position affected susceptibility to a particular disease. In this case, an eye disease, something called age-related macular degeneration. I'm going to walk you through changes in our understanding. I'm starting at 2005 because it's the start of many recent developments. If we'd looked before 2005 across all common human diseases, there would have been maybe a handful of places on our genome where we reliably knew that variations in DNA sequence played a role in those diseases. That was the position in 2005. There are a few more discoveries in 2006, a couple for a different disease, another one for the same eye disease. In 2007, the position started to change quite a lot. So each lollipop marks a location on the genome, and the color of the lollipop changes for each of the diseases that's involved. I'll give you a little key later if you really care. So this huge, what seemed to us at the time, huge expansion in our understanding of genetic variants associated with disease led Science magazine, the other one of the major kind of pop general science academic journals. Each year it, in a somewhat pompous way, proclaims on what has been the scientific breakthrough of that year. And at the end of 2007, it picked this change, then quite substantial change, in our understanding of genetic variants and their association with disease as its scientific breakthrough of the year. Actually, the change has continued, so this is what the picture looked like through 2008, 2009, and to about 9 months ago. So now it's the case that there are over 1,500 variants associated reliably with more than 200 diseases or conditions. Remember, in 2005 we had a handful, and now there's been an explosion. Each one of those has in it clues to the biology of the diseases. Here's a list. There won't be a quiz afterwards. You're welcome to get a drink without knowing about this. Here's a list of some of the diseases and conditions. If you look hard, heart disease is involved. Many of the cancers, breast cancer, colon cancer, type 1 and type 2 diabetes, conditions like weight and heights in here somewhere, arthritis and so on. Many, many different conditions now have the property that we've got some clues, we've got reliable information about genetic variants that are associated with those diseases. How do we do those? We do them through relatively simple experiments. Experiments that are called genome-wide association studies. It's tempting to say they're not rocket science. Well, they're not rocket science in the obvious sense that this is biology and not astrophysics. They're also not rocket science in the colloquial sense that the idea underlying them isn't very difficult. What do? In one of these experiments, we take a lot of people who are sick with the disease we care about, say heart disease, and a lot of people who aren't sick with it. In practice, we just take a random sample from the population, so a small proportion might be, but that's a statistical issue we know how to handle. So a lot of sick people, a lot of healthy people, and we measure them at many places in their DNA, maybe 500,000 or 1,000,000 of them. And then what we look for are particular positions where there's a variant which is at a different frequency in the patients, the cases, from the controls. Why is that interesting? Well, if you think the other way around, suppose it were the case that if you have a T at this position in your DNA code, you're more likely to get heart disease than if you have a C there, then the T will be more common in people with heart disease than it will be in people without heart disease. So we just look for these differences in frequency. I'll come back to it in a little while. There's an immediate statistical challenge because we're measuring many, many things, 500,000 of them. Though there will be differences between the sick people and the healthy people due to chance, and we want to be really convinced when we're looking at so many things that any differences we see are due to real effects and not just chance differences. Why do this? Well, most of us in the field would probably point to two different sorts of reasons, and most of us, I think, would put more weight on the first of these than the second. The first is the following. For all of these common human diseases, in spite of, in most cases, decades, and in some cases, centuries of research, we know depressingly little about the biology underlying the disease. We don't really know exactly what's going on in the processes that trigger heart disease, or diabetes, or schizophrenia, or arthritis, or in some cases, many of the cancers. So, how might genetics be important? It's a whole new way of thinking about the disease process. We kind of throw out we complement the previous approach, which kind of starts at the top through the symptoms and works down, and instead say, actually what I'll do is I'll look across the genome in an unbiased way, and I'll try and find positions in the genome where there are genetic variants which matter for that disease. So suppose I do find a place where a T in your DNA at this position makes you more likely to get heart disease than a C. That's a clue. How do we take advantage of that clue? We need to work out what's going on within the bodies of people with the T, which is different from what's happening in people with the C. So how is that change in DNA, or probably something near it, how are those changes translated into biological differences? If we know that, we then know some aspect of the process that leads to people getting the disease. So genetics allows us a whole new entree into disease biology. Now, there's some way in time from knowing that the T or the C matters to understanding what the biology is and then trying in some cases to harness that to develop new drugs. But that's the path that these discoveries put us on, and one in which about which many of us are optimistic that over time, and probably long times, 10, 20 years, we might be able to harness that extra information in many cases for much more effective drug treatments. So that's why most of us would say we're in the game, as it were. But there's another possible consequence, and that is that if we know about genetic variants that affect risk, we can measure those genetic variants in individuals and try and predict the risk of a particular person, me say, of getting certain diseases according to my genetic makeup. At the moment, we can't do that particularly well. I showed you 1,500 places or so on the genome where genetic variants affect risks of disease. They almost all have rather small effects on risk. So maybe if you had the T rather than the C, it increased your risks of heart disease by 20% or 10% or so. Now, the fact that the change in risk is small doesn't stop it from telling us really important biology. But it does mean that individually it's not very helpful in predicting your disease risk. Nonetheless, as we understand more, we will get better at identifying individuals at particular risk from certain diseases. So those of us in the field try quite hard to, those of you on the academic side, try quite hard to publish our findings, and we were lucky enough to do so in a paper in 2007 with what was then the largest study of this kind, looking at 7 different common diseases. Sometimes when we do academic work, the press also get interested, and we watch with trepidation to see how they'll handle it. So The Independent, now a newspaper I think fondly of as a consequence of this, they were very excited. They devoted quite a bit of their front page to these findings. Interestingly, they devoted the rest of their front page to one of Britain's more controversial avant-garde artists, and we've never quite understood the juxtaposition of the two, but we didn't make much of a fuss. The Daily Telegraph, another very serious newspaper, also got excited about our findings. They were similarly excited on the front page about this. England get back on track. So you've heard that I'm Australian, so I watch England sporting successes and failures with some bemusement. What was this wonderful moment in the history of English football? It's when England had reached the dizzy heights of beating Estonia 3-0 in the qualification process for Euro 2008, and we all know that ended rather unhappily with Steve McLaren and the umbrella and the lack of qualification. But anyway, it was exciting at the time. I want to spend a little bit of time giving you a sense for some of the science underlying these experiments and some of the statistics involved. So here's some real data from our early experiment around what was probably the most interesting single finding of ours and a number of other groups published at the same time. So what are we looking at here? Here is a region of one of the human chromosomes, as it happens, human chromosome 9. Each of these black dots is one of these positions, we've measured 500,000 of them in total, but one of the positions where we've measured the frequency of a variant in the cases, the sick people, in this case with heart disease, and the controls. And the height of a point up here on the y-axis is a measure of the strength of the statistical evidence for a difference in frequency at that position between the cases and the controls. For statisticians, it's minus log 10 of a p-value of a very simple test for a difference in the frequency. And what you see as you walk along the chromosome is kind of what we know as background noise on the left, what we also know as background noise on the right, and then in the middle there's a huge jump in significance, in evidence, for differences in frequency. And so the actual p-value here is something like 10 to the minus 13. Even in a world where you're doing lots of comparisons, that's very strong evidence. So this is a variant associated with heart disease. It turns out, I said most of these variants have individually small effects on risk. This one is also relatively small, but if you have 2 copies of the wrong version of this variant, your risk of heart disease is increased by something like 60 or 70%. So it's not so different in terms of its effect on risk to, say, cholesterol, one of the biomarkers that we measure and use medically. I said these findings potentially give us clues into the disease process. So what would you do if you were us or someone who had found this? You'd look in the region where there seems to be this signal, and you try and find, well, you actually look up in the reference sequence, what are the genes there? Because probably we think these variants are controlling the way certain genes work, when they work, or how much they work, or in which tissues they're active, and so on. There are 2 genes in this region. They're called, again, pretty unremarkably, CDKN2A and 2B. One of the most exciting things about all of the findings I've described is that in most cases, the genes involved were on no one's list as potentially being relevant for that disease. If you'd spoken to someone who worked on heart disease, and this exercise had been done because they'd been trying to do these experiments, about which genes they thought might be important in the disease process, no one would have listed these genes. Tantalizingly, these 2 genes are actually quite well known to biomedical researchers. They're well known because they play a critical role in cancers. This discovery is now almost exactly 5 years old, and we still don't know, first of all, whether it is these genes that are responsible, or maybe something else. And we also don't know whether the connection with cancer is kind of tantalizing accident or somehow telling us something about biology. But we will. There's a lot of effort underway to try and work out exactly what's going on here. I just mentioned in passing, for the statisticians, there are gray dots on this picture, which you may well be able to see. I said the black dots were positions where we've measured differences between the cases and the controls. The gray dots are positions where we've used statistical models to predict what we would see if we did measure. It turns out that variants near each other along human chromosomes are highly correlated. That's why there are a bunch of things that show strong evidence near each other. And if we learn about that correlation structure, we can use it to predict what we would... We can learn about the correlation structure at lots of variants, then measure some of them, and we can use statistical models to predict what we would see at the variants we haven't actually measured. So it turns out that process works remarkably well. The accuracy of those prediction methods is something like 96 or 97 or 98%. In this particular case, it doesn't add much to our understanding of what's going on. In some cases, we see that something that we haven't actually measured but can predict well at has a much higher signal, and that's an important thing in giving us clues towards the biology. Here's a picture from a recent paper that we were involved in another large study. So the last picture showed you one part, about 2 million bases, DNA positions on chromosome 9. This is the whole human genome actually shown vertically. So there are about 500,000 dots, light blue and dark blue dots on this picture, on human chromosome 1 and 2 and 3 and so on as the colors alternate. And now strength of evidence is shown moving in this direction to the right from the axis. This is a very large study we undertook for multiple sclerosis, about 10,000 sick people and about 15,000 healthy people. Very challenging statistically because the individuals are sampled from a bunch of different countries which have European in Europe, or countries like Australia and America with European ancestry. But in some cases, we had cases from some country and no controls, in others, controls and not cases. And that, I won't go into the details, but that causes major problems in doing the statistical comparisons because these variants differ in frequency in different parts of the world. And we had to use relatively sophisticated statistical techniques for the statisticians, a mixed model approach, to try and untangle the differences we were seeing to do with geography from the differences due to the disease. That was successful, and because it was such a large study, each position in red here, and there are something like 60 of them, represents a position where we're sure there are differences that matter for the disease. Something like 35 of them were novel in this paper. We were able, because we had so many findings, although each of these associations identifies only a region of the genome, we were able to show that those regions contained a massive excess, compared to chance, again, statistics was involved, of genes involved in the immune system. Multiple sclerosis is a very debilitating disease. There had been a lot of debate in the field about how important the immune system was known to play a role, but whether what happened in the degeneration of the nerves that characterizes multiple sclerosis, whether that was driven by another process, and then the immune system kind of came along to see what it could do, or whether it was errors in the immune system, autoimmune problems, that caused the primary degeneration rather than responding to it. And I think a clear consequence of our findings is that it was that the immune system does indeed play a key role. Not only that, but by looking at the genes involved, we're able to identify a particular part of the immune system as being critical to the pathogenesis of multiple sclerosis. I talked about heart disease earlier. We've recently published work looking at stroke, something like the third or fourth biggest killer in the world, and of that order in Western societies as well. There are different subtypes of stroke. We identified a variant for one of the subtypes, and I'll come back to those differences in a minute, that, again, if you have two copies of the wrong version of the variant, it roughly doubles your risk of this type of stroke. So it's quite serious, and again, points, we think, to interesting biology in a gene unmemorably called HDAC9, but one for which there are already drugs available for other conditions. So that's quite promising, and it may be, if this is the key gene, that we'll be slightly closer on the path to having a therapy than we were otherwise. And just the last substantive piece of data I want to show you is here. We were able in our study, there are different subtypes of stroke. Clinicians already classify stroke into subtypes. There are a number of genetic variants known for those subtypes, so we were able to ask the question of whether particular genetic variants affect just one subtype or more than one. So if you look at the bottom left picture, both of these go together. There are three different subtypes. What's shown in this picture on the right are estimates of the effect of a particular variant on each of the subtypes. One of them, the estimated effects in terms of odds ratios are 1.2 or 1.3. That's saying having one copy of the variant increases your risk by 20 or 30% for one subtype of stroke. But for the other two, the odds ratio estimates were bang on one, saying it doesn't seem to have any effect. So these are now the four known, this was the new one we had, the four known genetic variants. And what you see are clear differences between the risk for the different subtypes of disease. The figures on the left, and I won't spend much time on them, are a Bayesian model comparison where we compare models that say this variant only affects this subtype for each of the possible subtypes, or it affects all subtypes the same, or perhaps it has a similar kind of effect on the subtypes, but with some randomness. And one of the interesting things about this aspect of our findings was that it seemed to show really clearly that these different types of stroke have completely different genetic mechanisms underlying them. They've been classified as different types of the disease, and we thought for a long time in genetics that one of the values of what we're doing is to be able to categorize diseases into subclasses. We think of diabetes or schizophrenia currently as one condition, but it's possible that it arises via a number of different routes. Genetics may give us a clue into that, and if we could stratify patients on the basis of their genetics, we could target drugs more effectively at them, is one of the big hopes. This is something I just mentioned briefly. This was a finding in our early study that we have a genetic variant associated with type 2 diabetes. That's the type of diabetes you get as you get older, kind of late middle age. When we looked more closely, it became clear to us that this variant didn't act primarily on type 2 diabetes risk. What it primarily did was to affect people's weight. And being overweight is itself a major risk factor for type 2 diabetes. So this was the first, we published it separately, it was the first example known of a genetic variant that affects weight. If you have two copies of the wrong version of the variant, wrong in a certain sense, then you'll be on average about 3 or 4 kilos, or half a stone if you're in imperial measurement, heavier. So it's not a huge effect, but it's not trivial. As I said, we published it separately. You can imagine that the headline writers had rather a field day with it. Even the Financial Times, the doyen of serious British reporting, thought this was interesting, not only on their front page, but in a leader where they applauded the fact that we made the results available rather than trying to protect the IPO. But by far, this is my favorite headline. I told you that there have been massive advances. I want to give you a sense of why they have happened and what's driving them. So part of it is obviously biology, but actually there are two other key components. One of them is the change in technology, which I'll say a little bit about in a minute. And the other one is our advances in informatics and statistics in being able to extract information from large amounts of genomic data. So here's a picture which shows the cost of DNA sequencing over about 20 years. And you don't really need to know the units. The key factor is that the cost of reading a DNA sequence has gone down by a factor of about 100 million in the last 20 years. And critically, it's gone down by a factor of about 10,000 over the last 4 years. So there's Moore's law, which tells us how quickly computing power will increase. This change is much more dramatic than that. There's the well-known biblical adage that one should know oneself, or that you should know thyself. I'm sure the writers of the Bible didn't quite mean it this way. But if you think in terms of your DNA, you can know yourself rather more cheaply now than would have been the case in the past. This is a picture of one of the top-end sequencing machines. I said that the Human Genome Project, which read one copy of the human genome, took scientists in many different countries, thousands of scientists, billions of dollars in about 10 years. One of these machines can produce the equivalent of about 8 human genomes in about a fortnight. So it's a huge change. And the cost is also, I've shown you how the costs are dropping. Current costs for reading the genome sequence of a single individual are about £3,000. And we all think, we can't quite see the path, but we all think that within a few years they'll be well under £1,000. And I'll come back to it, but in terms of medical tests, that makes reading an entire DNA sequence comparable in cost with many of the other tests that we routinely undertake in meds. They generate lots of data, these machines. So a single run of one of those machines generates 500 gigabytes of data, so that's much more than would fit on the hard disk of your laptop, for example. In a large study we're involved in with collaborators in the US, we're looking at about 2,700 individuals who have type 2 diabetes. That project will generate 50 terabytes of data. So we're generating some of the data in Oxford by reading the DNA sequences of these individuals. Centers in the US are also generating data. The data volumes are so high that even in the age of the internet, the only practicable way to get data from them to us is to put it on a hard disk and send it through the mail. It's extraordinary that we have to do that, but the data volumes are such that it just swamps any internet connection. We don't actually put it in the mail, we send it by FedEx, but the effect is the same. And one of the biggest challenges in the field, and an area where, so I've told you how technology is getting much more efficient, so you can now read DNA sequences relatively easy and cheaply. One of the biggest challenges in the field, and I think the big bottleneck as we move forward to try and take these advances into clinical medicine, is the lack of, the need for, so any of you who are interested, and the current lack of good statistical methods for extracting information from this data at all sorts of levels. The way, I'll just give you one example, the way these DNA sequencing machines work, you can think of it, it's as if they chop a human genome up into gazillions of pieces, each 100 letters long. And that's what the machine gives you back. So the first stage is what we call mapping. You need to kind of work out where this 100 base pairs fits on the human genome. They're measured reasonably reliably, but you need lots and lots of them in the same place to be convinced what the sequence variant is at that position. There are all sorts of statistical questions about mapping them reliably and using that information to call variants. That's just one example that's absolutely critical. There's also a major bottleneck in, as I said, in analysis. So this is kind of a cartoon. But what's shown there is 1/1,000,000th of one human genome. And the way people like me, or in practice these days, the people in my group, make a living is to look at all of this data for many individuals and try and spot the patterns, which things are more common in this wealth of information in the sick people than the healthy people. That's quite hard to do still at a research level. We need to get it to the stage where it's something that doctors can make sense of and in a way which is robust enough to be used clinically. I want to give you, to end, a few examples where genetics and genomics, I think, either already is or will very soon impact in a major way on healthcare. The general idea is what's called personalized medicine or precision medicine, and it has a number of aspects. I'll talk you through those. So one of those is a field called pharmacogenomics. Genetics controls many things in us. One of the things it controls is the way we react to drugs. Recreational drugs, but in this context, therapeutic drugs, both in the sense of how effectively we metabolize a drug and whether or not we have side effects. So genetics is important in that, and I'll give you a couple of examples. One of them, so a drug which is widely prescribed for people who are at risk of stroke or heart attacks is warfarin. It thins the blood. That's a helpful thing if you're at risk. If you thin blood too much, that's not so good. You fall over and hit your head and you can have a serious bleed and potentially die from it. So there's a huge amount of effort invested currently in getting the initial dosage right of warfarin for someone. And people are very closely monitored. It turns out that genetics is part of the story as to how large a dose is needed. And we know about which genetic variants are involved. This is actually some data on me from one of the companies that will measure your DNA and tell you about various things you're at risk of. And it says in terms of a warfarin dose, the kind of dose that would be effective to start on. We're not yet at the stage where this is reliable enough to be used routinely clinically. It needs large clinical trials, but some of those are planned or underway. We also recently found genetic variants that affected the way in which people respond to metformin, which is the most common drug for type 2 diabetes. A serious issue with many drugs are side effects. It's not so uncommon to have, after many years of development work, a drug which works really well in 95% of the population and does something dreadful in the other 5%. And what happens there is that the drug is withdrawn from the market. The hope, and this is one example, is that if we know enough about genetics, we could identify in advance the people who are at risk of the side effect and just not give them the drug. So Vacavir is a drug which is an antiretroviral used to treat HIV, the virus that leads to AIDS. Just like in my generic example, there's a very serious side effect that affects a small number of people, so what had been a great drug had to be withdrawn. Research showed that there's a particular genetic variant called HLA-B5701, and that if you carry that variant, you're at very high risk of the side effect, and if you don't have the variant, you never see the side effect. So that genetic knowledge now allows a test to be done in advance to check whether patients are at risk, and a drug which worked well for most people but had to be withdrawn can now be used again. The next big area where genetics is important is cancer, and cancer is fundamentally a disease of the genome. What happens in a cancer tumor? So each of the cells in our body carries our DNA, and to a first and kind of second approximation, they all carry the same version of our DNA. That's not true in cancer cells. What happens in cancer cells is that something gets seriously messed up in the DNA of the cancer cell. Its instruction manual is changed. If you think of it as a car, either the accelerator is kind of stuck on, so it just keeps growing, or maybe the brake is broken, so it doesn't, those cells don't die when they're supposed to. So what's going on in tumors is they're just cells with a screwed up version of our instruction manual. And now for the first time, we have the property of actually reading the DNA sequence in tumor cells and learning for this tumor in this individual, what's the error, and maybe we should treat that differently. I'll give you a sense of this. So this is a kind of pictorial representation of the genome of a particular tumor, in this case a skin cancer tumor, from a single individual. Genomes are already complicated things. There are 3 billion bits of information. This is a way of showing how the genome in the tumor is different from the genome in the rest of the individual cells. These things in the middle represent very large chunks of DNA which aren't where they should be. Then there are about 40 of those. Then there are about 66 instances of quite large chunks of DNA which we would normally have two copies of and either have more than two or fewer than two. And then if we looked at individual positions in this tumor, there are almost 35,000 individual positions which have changed. That's one cell. Now I'm going to show you more of these pictures moving to breast cancer. So we currently think of breast cancer as a type of cancer. We currently classify cancers by where they happen in the body. So that's one of these pictorial representations of the genome of one woman's breast cancer. That's another woman's, and another, and another, and another, and another. What I want you to notice, the key thing is they're all quite different. They're all rather complicated, and they're all quite different. And again, instead of thinking of breast cancer as one type of cancer, we're now able to take a rather more sophisticated and nuanced view and classify cancers according to the genetic changes which are driving them. Actually, breast cancer is already an example where genetics is used very successfully in determining potential treatments and also in assessing prognosis. Here's a recent and very encouraging example, back to melanoma. It turns out that about half of the skin cancers have mutations in a particular gene, another unmemorable name, it's called BRAF, and something in the 600th position gets changed from what it usually is to something else. So that's a particular genetic change that many of these melanomas have. And you can think of it as causing the gene which produces this stuff, BRAF, to stay in the on position. So someone had the bright idea of developing, so technically what's called a selective inhibitor. You can think of that as kind of something which mops up the additional enzyme that's produced. Not the normal enzyme, but this kind of slightly odd enzyme which is produced, which seems to be play a key role in the development of the cancer. Here's a picture from a very early trial. So this is an individual, you don't need to know much about imaging, apart from their brain up here and their bladder, everything that's colored is bad news. That's cancer tumor. So early trials only happen in people who are really badly off because of potential safety risks and so on. That's what they look like before the treatment was first given. That's what they look like 2 weeks later. So developing a clever drug that took advantage of the particular change in the tumor was hugely successful. I said this is an early trial. These patients have been followed rather longer now. It's not quite the miracle drug that this picture suggests. It doesn't kind of cure all of these cancers forever. But the first relatively substantially sized clinical trials were published at the end of last year, and it very substantially improves on existing treatments for melanoma. And I think one of the big changes in healthcare over about the next 5 years is it will become routine to sequence the genomes of the cells in tumors and to use that information to try and cleverly choose drugs which could help treat them. I've talked almost entirely, apart from my salamander and chimpanzee example, about genomes of humans. All creatures have genomes, and the bacteria that infect us also have genomes. Actually, they're much smaller than our genomes, and they're much easier and cheaper to sequence. So we can do that relatively easily now, and it suggests a move. So this is one particular bacteria that we're involved in studying, Clostridium difficile, which is responsible for diarrhea, typically in hospitals, typically in elderly people as a result of them being given antibiotics. It's bad news in general and can be actually very serious. And there's major interest in both the biology of it and what's causing it to spread in hospitals. So here's a kind of pictorial representation of the genomes. These creatures have circular genomes. All you're meant to notice here from this little cartoon is that they're all different. It's relatively easy to read them, and they're all different. And I think, again, we'll move to a world where it just becomes routine clinically to sequence the bug that's infecting you. That, first of all, allows the clinician to confirm what it is that's infecting you and that they've got the diagnosis right, or if they're not sure, to learn. Secondly, we'll just be able to look at the DNA sequence and read off for that bug whether it's resistant to this type of antibiotic or that one. And finally, we'll be able to, in real time, track the spread of infections and epidemics. We'll be able to check in real time whether this person in this bed in a hospital who's infected with C. diff, for example, was infected by the person in the other bed in this ward or by some other route. And that'll make a big difference. Knowing that information in real time will make a big difference in hospitals and actually in the community to infection control. Here's one picture where an early version of that, where I won't go into the details, but we were able to use this kind of genetic profiling or fingerprinting to trace the spread in America of a particular bug, something called pneumococcus. There's a vaccine against pneumococcus, which targets a certain number of versions of the bacteria. It targets one part of their cells, as it were, and that's encoded for by one part of its DNA. Some bacteria kind of swap that. So the vaccine recognizes certain of these capsules, and so the clever little bugs just swap the DNA that encodes their capsule with one of the versions of the bug which isn't recognized by the vaccine. This happened. There's a version which we're able to trace which arose in the east of the US, so this is its prevalence over time, and then spread throughout the country. Finally, I want to talk about work we're involved in Oxford to try and push really hard to see what kinds of things DNA sequencing might help with in clinical medicine. So we're investigating lots and lots of examples. I'll give you one. So there was a situation where a couple had a child who had a very major, both learning difficulties and issues with their skull, and we were able to study that. So here's a picture of the girl when she was young. Yeah, I'm not an expert in this stuff, but you don't need to know too much to know that her head shape is unusual. And that's a scan of her skull. We all have solid skulls, or we do, but she doesn't, unfortunately. So the clinician involved, this wasn't a standard syndrome which had already been studied. He assumed that it was because of a genetic change, probably the girl was unlucky in that either in the path from her mother to her or her father to her, there was a change in some bit of DNA that was really important. So we were able to sequence, to read the DNA of both parents and the child, to look through, and there's quite a lot of statistical and analytical work underpinning this, but to look through, and there was a key mutation in a gene which had already been associated with conditions a bit like this. So that needs to be verified, but it was pretty strong evidence to the clinician that that was the reason for her symptoms. That had some consequences in terms of the way he thought about managing the condition. The most important thing was that it did confirm that there was just a very rare chance change from one of the parents to the child. The parents involved were very worried about risks to future children. And the clinician was able to tell them as a result of the genetics that actually future children wouldn't be at any increased risk compared to other members of the population because this, as it were, rare one-off change was very unlikely to happen more than once. That was one of the first examples, and again it attracted happily some interest in the press, of DNA sequencing in a clinic in other kinds of healthcare. It's time I stopped, and I'll do that. I hope I've given you a sense of the excitement in modern genetics and a little bit of a taste of the role of statistics and mathematics in making sense of the large amounts of data. I think it's pretty clear to us that we live in reasonably interesting times. There's been huge advances in technology. You only have to think of personal computers and laptops and mobile phones and so on, which have iPads, iPhones, and so on, which have changed the technological world dramatically. Also, in the last 20 years or so, massive advances in our understanding of the physical world, from subatomic scales up to astronomical scales. But I think it's the case that when we look back on this time, in the way that we see the early part of the last century as a golden age of physics, I think when we look back on this time, what will stand out is that it was the time at which we really started to understand our DNA. We really started to understand the language in which it was encoding so much of the complication and the systems biology that underpins us and other living creatures. I think in time, in some instances, and I've tried to give you a sense of this, those changes will happen very soon. Cancer sequencing, for example, sequencing of bacteria, in others over a longer time scale. But in time, it will have a big impact, I think, on human health and healthcare. And all of that's because of what we think of, and some of us are lucky enough to work in, as the genetic revolution. Thanks very much.
Thank you.